This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berling. Coming up, the demilitarized zone in Korea. Should it be maintained as a nature preserve? There's more ocean in the United States territory than land, but Congress wants to find a better way to manage it. We jet through South and Central America and islands in the Atlantic and Pacific and get a snapshot of El Nino effects. And sapodilla fruits are being picked in Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories coming up on The Environment Show. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berling. For more than 45 years, a 2.5-mile-wide, 220-mile-long stretch of land has separated communist North Korea from South Korea. Before the demilitarized zone was established at the cessation of fighting in the Korean War, much of the land consisted of farms. The demilitarized zone, or DMZ, was created as a buffer between the countries located along the 38th parallel. This guarded area has grown back and is now a rich forest area that is home to many endangered species. Although resumed peace talks recently fell apart, some environmental groups and scientists want to protect the area from development which might occur after a peace treaty. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
Just last month, North Korean officials appealed to the South Koreans to end 50 years of confrontation and distrust. The Northerners say they want to work toward reconciliation, a surprising move considering the North Koreans have long seemed content on remaining separated from their southern ancestors. While many Koreans would welcome the reunion, some environmentalists are afraid the now lush DMZ would be ruined by developers, some of whom already have their hopes set on gaining access to the forest areas. Dr. Robert Lee, Assistant Director of the Asia Program for the International Division at the Wildlife Conservation Society, is among a group of scientists and researchers that is trying to get both North and South Korea to agree to keep the DMZ protected should they ever reunite. Lee says while the South Korean government has responded favorably to the idea of preserving the DMZ, communications with the North are limited.
In terms of the North Korean government, as you know, it's fairly isolated. So there's not a great deal of communication, but the three organizations that are putting this DMZ forum together, that is the Wildlife Conservation Society, Penn State University, and the Institute for Public Administration, have been in contact with the state center for nature conservation, which is sort of the conservation branch of North Korean government. And there seems to be some willingness on their part to participate in this process.
The North's overtures may appear promising to some, but actual reconciliation between the two sides may still be a long way off. Dr. Lee, a Korean-American, says there is a lot of bad blood between the North and South. Nonetheless, working out a deal to preserve the DMZ could be the start of something much larger. One of the key issues in any reunification discussions would be the landmines that remain in the DMZ. But until that point, Dr. Lee says the United States has refused to lift the ban on landmines.
Well, that seems to be a fear on the part of the United States government, that the landmines are there for security reasons. That is, if the North Korean government ever decided to attack South Korea, they would be there as a barrier. In terms of how the South Koreans, that is, the public, feels about the landmines, I'm not really sure. I think, for the most part, South Koreans are very eager to be reunited with their families in North Korea and their people, essentially, because North and South Korea are racially, ethnically, linguistically, culturally identical. So there's a great deal of support by the people of South Korea to clear the landmines. Now, whether the South Korean government and the United States government agree to clear the landmines is another matter.
The landmines are important because they serve as a buffer from North Korea. They also keep people out of the DMZ, allowing the forest and wildlife an opportunity to flourish. If the landmines were removed, that protection would be lost. The DMZ Forum has been created to mobilize scientists, governmental leaders, and others to establish forums to support preservation of the DMZ ecosystems and to support research in the Korea Peace Bioreserves system in the DMZ corridor. Besides the DMZ, the preservation plan also includes the Civilian Control Zone, or CCZ, a 3-mile-wide-by-12-mile-long buffer zone south of the DMZ. Dr. Lee believes an agreement between North and South Korea is the only way to protect the 1,200 plant species, 90 freshwater fish species, mammal species once believed to be extinct, as well as black bear and musk deer.
We find two species of birds that are very endangered. That is, we find the white-naped crane and the red-crowned crane that make their wintering grounds in the CCZ, as well as the DMZ. So, although we don't know about the biota of the DMZ itself, by looking at the CCZ, we get a very good glimpse of what might be out there in the DMZ.
Besides the wildlife, Dr. Lee says the plan is necessary for humans living on the Korean Peninsula. He says the peninsula was once called the land embroidered with 3,000 rivers and mountains. But in the last 30 years, South Korea has lost much of its natural resources.
You have urban sprawl, air pollution, pollution of major rivers and lakes, health problems, and so forth. And obviously, loss of biodiversity is one of the products of environmental degradation. So now, in South Korea, what we have is a lot of animal species are either endangered or extirpated. And the DMZ ecosystems is a very good cross-section of the Korean Peninsula in terms of representing the ecosystems on that piece of land. And that, joined with other reserves throughout the peninsula, will help bring back that idea of the land embroidered with 3,000 rivers and mountains.
Dr. Lee believes supporters of the plan aren't being naive in hoping North and South Korea will approve the plan. He believes the two sides can work together, even if the two never reunite. An international conference is scheduled for September to discuss the DMZ preservation plan. It remains to be seen whether diplomats from North and South Korea accept the invitations. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
In this year of the ocean, our territorial waters are beset with threats to their ecological health, which include overfishing, pollution from runoff, and even harvesting of organisms for pharmaceutical manufacture. A bill is under consideration in the U.S. House of Representatives, which would establish a commission to determine how we can better manage these ocean resources. The bill is known as the Oceans Act, and it has already passed the Senate. At issue is who is in charge in the Exclusive Economic Zone, or EEZ. Roger McManus, president of the Center for Marine Conservation, recently testified in support of the Oceans Bill before a House subcommittee. He describes the size and the nature of the EEZ.
President Reagan, in the wake of conversations regarding the law of the sea, established our authority to manage our resources out to 200 miles, and that's what's called the Exclusive Economic Zone. For 200 miles out from our shores, all around the continental United States and Alaska, into the Caribbean, the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and other holdings that we have in the Caribbean, and out to Hawaii and the other holdings that we have in the Pacific Ocean, from each point of land for 200 miles around, the United States has the authority to manage its resources in those areas. Now, other nations still have the right of transit through those areas, and we don't inhibit free and fair transit, but for as far as resource development, we have control over those resources. But the United States of America has the largest exclusive economic zone of any nation. In fact, we have over 4 million square miles of ocean that's under our jurisdiction, compared to only about 3.5 million square miles of land. So from one perspective, you could say most of the United States of America is ocean, not land.
McManus says we need a plan for the management of these ocean resources and somebody in charge of implementing it.
Well, we're very concerned about the future of management of the oceans and the resources of the oceans. And in particular, we're concerned because the United States has no plan for how it will manage the territorial seas of the United States. And we don't have any agency or any federal government agency that will lead us in this effort. So we've been very supportive of legislation that has been introduced in both the Senate and the House now, which would establish a commission of experts that would re-examine how we're managing our coastal waters and offshore waters and the resources that they hold, and come to some conclusions about how we might be able to improve management in the future.
Given the plethora of government agencies and commissions, I asked McManus why we need another one.
Well, the problem is we have lots of agencies that are carrying out independently a variety of regulatory activities. We do have the National Marine Fisheries Service, for example, as you mentioned, that manages our fishery resources. And we do have the Minerals Management Service that manages oil and gas development. But these agencies frequently don't talk to each other, and in some cases they're engaged in activities that adversely affect the objectives of the other agency. When something comes up, like recently there was a request for a permit to establish a aquaculture facility in the exclusive economic zone, what happened was is the only agency that had any control over this was the Army Corps of Engineers under the Rivers and Harbors Act of the 19th century. And basically the only authority they had was to evaluate whether the aquaculture facility would be a navigational hazard or not. The National Marine Fisheries Service and the Environmental Protection Agency had a lot of concerns about that proposed facility, but there was no authority in law for them to express a view one way or another that the Army Corps of Engineers could consider.
That was Roger McManus, president of the Center for Marine Conservation, commenting on the need for a commission to determine how the United States can best manage our exclusive economic zone.
Under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade, he'd let us in.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. What's on your mind? Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Last summer, we reported on the appearance of El Niño as the waters warmed in the South Pacific. Subsequently, we've talked to people in various places about the effect of El Niño on the land, on rivers, on wildlife, and on various economies. Now, as El Nino is winding down, Environment Show Advisory Council member John D. Wirth, who is professor of history and environmental history at Stanford University, gives us a view of the effects of El Nino on the South American continent. Several days ago, he concluded a barnstorming lecture tour by chartered jet in which he covered South and Central America, as well as parts of the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean, in less than 3 weeks. With El Nino in mind, here is what he saw.
Starting out from California, of course, it's been raining hard, so we're well aware of El Nino out here on the West Coast. Our first stop was in Canaima, in the Roraima Upper Amazon Basin in Venezuela. And there, the first thing we noticed as we were flying in was how dry the landscape is. It hasn't rained for months. The rain is just starting. And in fact, Angel Falls virtually has no water in it. So that was the first effect on the eastern side of the continent of South America. The rainfall is drastically reduced because of El Nino. After poking around some very interesting landscapes, nonetheless, we went to Manaus. And there, what was very noticeable were the fire notices all around the city, warning people to be very careful about backyard fires. And in fact, this was an insight. The whole Amazon basin is very dry, tinder dry, and there's some spontaneous fires that we've been reading about, but it was nonetheless sobering to see notices on the public streets about in a major city on the edge of the Rio Negro, part of the Amazon itself, warning people about fire dangers, the last place you'd expect. But again, this is the effect of El Nino. Going by 767, like this great space machine, you see it as a whole. It was a very unusual way to travel. The longest flight we took, in fact, was to Easter Island. That took 5.5 hours. And there, the effects of El Nino were a delight for us, anyway. The island was emerald green like San Francisco in January and February with the rains we have out here. So instead of the usual scene with those extraordinary monoliths and the Easter Island culture in a barren landscape, it was in an emerald green, enchanting landscape, absolutely gorgeous. Buoyed by that, we proceeded on to the Galapagos, traveling north and east, if everyone has the geography in mind, and spent 3 days cruising by boat among several islands, and there the effects of El Nino were extraordinarily speeded up, as, of course, everything in the Galapagos is environmentally and biologically speeded up in the sense that Darwin's finches were making out, like, literally, in many ways, like they rarely do. There's a profusion of things, of greenery and things for them to eat because of El Nino. So their population is skyrocketing, and the males are singing. They can't stop singing. The females are laying eggs at an extraordinary rate. The population is way, way up. But on other islands right nearby, the marine birds are dying and are doing very poorly because of the temperature inversion in the water, which has drastically reduced their fishing opportunities, so that several of the different varieties of boobies, the frigate birds, even the marine iguanas are under stress, doing very poorly. And I think this was a sobering sight to see the number of dead chicks and the search for food that just isn't available, whereas right nearby is this extraordinary singing of Darwin's finches. A lesson in that, I suppose, about the power of nature to affect our lives and perhaps speed up the pace of evolution, which may be happening as a result of this year, a natural process, but nonetheless devastating in its power to see that. And then finally, the last leg of the trip to Tikal to see the great Mayan city, and to get there we flew over the length of or the breadth of Guatemala and looked down on, again, a very dry landscape. And one which was on fire. Not huge sheets of fire, but just smoke over the whole country. And one could see graphically the effects of massive internal migration from the highlands into the lowlands. And in fact, the Tikal area is under stress from people moving into the forest, very rapid deforestation, lots of fires, and the need to accommodate people who, for whom there are no longer niches in the highlands where they've lived for centuries, moving into an area where their corn and bean culture is not adequate for the thin soils of the lowlands. And then back to San Francisco, where right on cue it's raining again.
That was Professor of History at Stanford University, John D. Wirth, with comments about the effects of El Nino in the Southern Hemisphere. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, sapodillas are being picked in southern Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. The fruit is believed to be native to the Yucatan and possibly other nearby parts of southern Mexico. Mark Ellenby of Ellenby Groves in Homestead, Florida, has been growing the fruit since the late 70s. He was forced to replant his trees after Hurricane Andrew ripped through the area in 1992. But today, Ellenby's young trees are providing 6 to 8 tons of fruit a year.
Everything is harvested by hand, and we do indeed use clippers. Some is ladder picking, but my trees are small enough now that we can get by with like a two-step stepladder. Our trees are only 8 to 10 foot tall. We can bring a branch to us with a hook and then clip the fruit. So every fruit is hand-picked and every fruit is hand-pecked. Now, there's one additional factor, is that the fruit has a pronounced sap. The sap is a useful sap, but not useful in our harvest. The sap is called chicle. It's the original natural chewing gum.
Chicle was a primary ingredient of chewing gum until gum became artificially manufactured. While the sapodilla resin doesn't provide the wintergreen or spearmint flavors we often associate with gum, the fruit is really the treat. Mark Ellenby says the taste of sapodilla makes up for its bland appearance.
If you've seen the outside of a kiwi fruit or the outside of a brown potato, it kind of looks like that on the outside. The size is anywhere from maybe 4 ounces, let's say kiwi fruit size, up to a pound or more, which would be apple size. The fruit can be round, it can be oblong, it can be elongated with pointed ends, and maturity is key. So we have to pick them when they're mature. It's tough to tell with a brown fruit. We pick them properly. We scratch, we wait for it to smooth out a bit on the outside, there's a mild color break, and then they'll ripen when they get into your hands in 5 or 7 days. When you open the fruit, it's tan on the inside, or a reddish brown, or a rich brown, and the flavor is like a pear that's been injected with brown sugar or maple syrup. It's a remarkable fruit.
The fruits can be seedless, but usually have in their center 3 to 12 hard, black, shiny, flattened seeds about 3/4 of an inch long. Sapodillas mature about 6 months after flowering, and they keep for about 2 weeks at room temperature. Sapodilla trees are a tropical hardwood, which means they grow slowly and are very sturdy. The Mayans in Guatemala even use the trees as support beams in their temples. The hardy stature of the sapodilla allows the tree to survive in frigid temperatures, high winds, and even the poor limestone rock soils of South Florida. Mark Ellenby says at maturity, sapodillas get extremely tall.
My trees are only 5 years and younger, and thus they're not tall, but the trees will get to be 40 or 50 feet tall with a 30-foot spread over time. I won't grow them that big in the orchard. We'll keep them controlled. But the tree is an evergreen tree with a leaf that's probably an inch to an inch and a half in width and maybe 3 to 4 inches long. It's just a magnificent tree with a wonderful growth habit and extremely well adapted to South Florida conditions and all through the islands. If travelers go down to Key West, they can find these in season, which is most of the year, but in my mind the season would be December through May, but there's some scattered production through the year, but they can find them in Key West at fruit stands.
Ellenby says sapodillas are mainly sold in Indian, Asian, and Hispanic grocery stores along the eastern seaboard, but he expects the fruit to one day appear in mainstream supermarkets. Quartered and served as fresh dessert fruit is Mark Ellenby's favorite way of eating sapodillas. Others prefer it in salads or mixed with orange juice and topped with whipped cream. If chewing gum really is a substitute for smoking, let's subsidize our tobacco farmers to grow sapodillas and produce real chicle. Global warming will even make that possible in North Carolina. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, shipwrecks provide habitat for fish on the ocean floor and remind us that staying afloat is not certain, given the power of nature and human fallibility. We talk green about another nuclear waste problem. This one is hot water being discharged off the coast of California. Winter still holds its grip in the high Rockies. But author David Peterson finds the tips of the aspen trees swelling despite the snow at their feet. Stay with us. The movie Titanic has once again brought sunken ships to the attention of the American public. Like the Titanic, people often believe that most wrecks are found in remote areas where few people have the opportunity to see them. But in his new book, titled Lost Voyages, Two Centuries of Shipwrecks and the Approaches to New York, author and scuba diver Bradley Sheard shows shipwrecks are more common than we might believe, especially in the East Coast. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with Sheard about these lost sailing vessels and their relationship to the sea around them.
The ships not only give a history of war and commerce and trade, but apparently of environmental degradation. Can you talk about the warship, the Mohawk, that sank in October 1917 and what happened in that area where the ship rests?
Sure. The Mohawk is really a fascinating story. The Mohawk sunk during World War I in a collision. Only about 12 miles outside New York Harbor. It was run down by a ship in a convoy that it was trying to protect and sank to the bottom. Little did it know, however, that shortly thereafter, in 1924, the city of New York began dumping its sewage sludge offshore in a specially designated area, a dump site designated for this municipal sewage sludge, and it happened to be right on top of the Mohawk's grave. So the Mohawk served essentially as a kind of a silent witness to this, what I call environmental debacle, in which raw sewage sludge was dumped offshore for 63 years. Every single day, tons and tons of sewage sludge were dumped offshore. Now, this sewage sludge just basically decimated the marine life in the area. Local fishermen used to call it the Dead Sea. You could actually see the color of the water change as you steam through this area on a charter boat. The Mohawk sat through all of this, being covered up slowly by all this sludge. Occasionally, sport divers would try and visit this wreck site. Usually, the visibility was virtually zero, and they could just almost explore only by feel. Eventually, the environmental awareness that came about during the 1960s and 70s began to start an outcry against this practice and the fact that it was really destroying marine life in the area. But probably the final straw that finally brought it to an end was fact that medical waste began appearing on the beaches during the 1980s. In fact, when we dove the Mohawk, we found medical waste and things. Hypodermic needles would be scattered all over the floor, medical tags, things of that nature. And then medical waste continued to appear on the beaches until the dumping was finally halted completely in 1992. Now, since that time, the Mohawk, the water has really cleared up tremendously there, and it's actually it's a diveable site now. And it's really amazing how much the area has recovered, considering the fact that for over six decades, it was basically covered in sewage sludge.
Sunken ships, as you mentioned, not only provide intriguing looks into the past for divers, but provide homes for marine life. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Shipwrecks really do provide this kind of platform on the middle of this sandy ocean floor where marine life can congregate. The wrecks themselves become completely encrusted and overgrown with different kinds of marine life, such as sea anemones, which are kind of a flower-like animal that literally carpet almost every square inch of a shipwreck, along with things like mussels. And all these animals will, of course, draw other forms of marine life. Starfish come to feed upon the mussels. Lobster and crab will be hiding in the crevices of these wrecks. And then, of course, come fish, which tend to school, seek the protection of these objects on the marine floor, and feed upon the other animals that have chosen to live there.
Humans often like to believe that we can outsmart nature. How do the ships represent this fallacy? Perhaps a timely example of this might be the Titanic, even though it's nowhere near these wrecks.
Oh, sure. The Titanic, of course, is the latest example of you know, the ship was supposed to be unsinkable and the largest moving object ever built by man. And it, of course, collided with an iceberg and sank. It wasn't the first ship to collide with an iceberg. However, there was an earlier ship called the Arizona, which had ran into an iceberg in the middle of the Atlantic and had run head on to it instead of the glancing blow that the Titanic saw and crumpled the bow up. In this case, however, the collision bulkhead held, and the ship was able to make it into St. John's, Newfoundland under its own power. What was actually interesting about that story is that the bookings on that ship actually increased after it, because people felt that any ship that could run into an iceberg and survive was the safest ship on the ocean. And there are many other instances, too, where, you know, another example might be the Andrea Doria, in which this was a passenger liner that sunk off Montauk in 1956 in a collision in the fog. And this was in the electronic age where man had invented all kinds of electronic devices, such as radar and Loran navigation systems, that should essentially prevent a collision at sea. And yet in the fog off Nantucket, the two ships came together, even though they both saw each other on their radar screens. They ended up running into one another. And this essentially represents the human fallibility. We can invent all these systems to see through fog with electronic radio waves, yet humans have to interpret the data that is presented and act accordingly.
That was author Bradley Sheard talking about his new book titled Lost Voyages, Two Centuries of Shipwrecks and the Approaches to New York. It's published by AquaQuest Publications. We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Like your car radiator, nuclear plants circulate water to cool down the reactors, and then they discharge it into a nearby ocean or lake or stream. And the question then is, what are the environmental consequences of this kind of activity? And our discussion is prompted by action recently taken by the San Diego Regional Water Quality or Water Control Board, and they have permitted Southern California Edison to discharge water about 25 degrees hotter than ambient ocean temperature from their San Onofre plant. And so, is that discharge a problem? What are the environmental consequences of this kind of discharge? If you've got some thoughts, we'd like you to let us know. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guest today
include Mary Jane Johnson. She's the San Onofre Environmental Manager for Southern California Edison Company. Paul Richter, he's Sanitary Engineering Associate with the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. And Dr. Steve Schroeder, and he's a professor at San Diego State University and a scientist with the California Coastal Commission. Mary Jane Johnson from California Edison, I'd like to start with you. Why is it that your plant wants to or needs to discharge water that's hotter than it had been previously permitted?
Well, thank you, Peter. There are several reasons why we need the additional 5 degrees. Keep in perspective that for up and down our coastline, other ocean dischargers are discharging at a higher temperature than what we are. But regardless of that, there are several reasons why we would request the additional increase. One is the biofouling. What has happened was that it breaks down to a micro and a macro. Macro is your heavy red grass, your kelp, and that increases the heat load that is needed for the coolant. Other items of less significance would be the additional heat loads associated with, we have two sister plants out here, and when certain operations occur during our activities, we get an additional heat load from the other unit, and that also increases the temperature for cooling. So
I gather what you're saying is that you've got more hot water than you can deal with, and you need to get rid of it. Is that kind of basically where you come out?
Well, we have in the past had to actually downpower the plant to stay within the requirements associated with the thermal plant.
And what that means for folk that don't understand the lingo is that you just have to produce less electricity because you can't get rid of the amount of heat that comes with that. Is that right?
That is correct. Well, during critical times of the year, we need to be at full capacity associated with our consumers, and we want to make sure that we're able to provide electricity when needed during critical times.
Okay. Professor Schroeder, what are the environmental issues, at least as it relates to this part of the ocean, that are involved when one has this kind of discharge taking place?
Well, the impacts from the San Onofre plant are of two general kinds. One has to do with discharged waters, and the other has to do with waters that are intaken or entrained. And the discharge effects, actually, heat is probably not as important as some other effects associated with the discharge, because the discharge is been well designed to get rid of the heat and in response to the thermal plan. But in the course of doing this, it moves a lot of water, and as a result of moving this water, both intaking inshore waters and discharging it and moving bottom waters and nearshore waters offshore, it creates dirty plumes, dirty water, turbidity plumes, and this goes over the kelp bed and reduces the amount of light that reaches the bottom, and this affects the small kelp plants.
So just so I understand that, what you're saying is that by changing the currents around, that is as much of an environmental problem as the fact that the water is just hotter than ordinary ocean water.
In fact, it's probably more important, because the discharge system of the power plant is pretty well designed to get rid of the heat.
Okay, and as you know, our volume or the constituents of what we're discharging, we're asking for no changes.
Okay, now I'd like
so
to,
before
we get into running the plant,
I'd like to get
Paul Richter's view. You're with the Regional Water Quality Control Board, which I guess actually issued the permit to allow the hotter water. What kind of environmental analysis do you folks do when you're faced with the kind of request that you got from the San Onofre plant here?
Well, for this particular project, we had a consultant review a lot of the application and the information that Southern California Edison submitted. Our review would basically go through CEQA, which is California Environmental Quality Act review, public notices, participation with other government agencies.
And in the course of this, did you look at the problems related to current that Professor Schroeder is talking about?
Well, basically, the change in the discharge will be temperature. The there has been some past findings by our board and by the California Coastal Commission regarding the turbidity, and we did look at turbidity and any potential increase from this change, and we found that, or staff's recommendation was that it was less than significant. So,
Professor Schroeder, let me ask you something. Is the kind of analysis that goes on when one makes this kind of a change adequate to deal with some of your concerns, such as the turbidity and the change in current and so on?
That's a good question. Well, the Coastal Commission staff looking at this concluded that there was some doubt as to whether or not the power plant would actually have an increased effect, mainly through turbidity, and recommended a negative declaration, but that it be mitigated or amended or however it's put to keep an eye on the possible negative effects associated with this possible increase.
So just so we don't get tied up in the legalese, what they basically said was, we've looked at it, we don't think there's enough of an impact here to require further study. All right, let's step back and let's look at this in a broader context. We've got nuclear plants all over the country. We know about nuclear waste, but they also discharge heat. And in fact, when I was Environmental Commissioner of the State of New York, we had a sort of a funny situation. There was a nuclear plant that wanted to shut down for maintenance, and it turned out that their discharges of hot water had caused fish to come into the river that normally weren't there in the wintertime. Mm. That brought eagles in who ate the fish, and the question was, if we shut down the plant, are we then going to have a negative impact on the endangered species, the eagle, or do we have to keep the plant going, even though it's due for maintenance, to save the eagle? So the bigger issue, I guess, is heat and nuclear plants, and how do we really kind of figure this one out? In terms of California Edison, do I understand that if you had to cool your or keep your discharges cooler, that would cost you money, either because you couldn't generate as much electricity or you'd have to operate your plant at a lower rate of output. Is that, Mary Jane Johnson, is that what would be the consequence as far as your plant is concerned?
During certain periods of time throughout the years in the past where warmer waters do come into our coastline, we have down-powered, which means loss of electricity to our consumer.
And that's because warmer water coming in, that with your discharge got your levels up too high? Was that what was happening?
Correct.
And how about El Nino? Has that affected you, where you've got warmer water coming in as a result of that?
Of course.
And just so we understand it, you use the water, you take it in from the ocean, use it for cooling and discharge it, so that if it's warmer when it comes in, you don't get as much cooling effect?
That is correct, in broad terms, yes.
And from your perspective, Dr. Schroeder, if you look at the whole California coast, is both the turbidity and the heat issue a significant environmental problem from your perspective?
Well, I think the more significant problem is would be the turbidity and associated effects. And at the top of the show, I mentioned intake effects, which causes loss of plankton and fish larvae, and produces the discharge effects are local, confined to the kelp bed. The intake effects are more general.
And just so I understand that, that's the pipe that sucks it all in.
Right.
And as you're sucking it into this great tube, it grinds and changes things in the process.
Right. And I just wanted to, we need to keep in mind here that these effects, we're talking about a kind of an incremental change in the operating characteristics of the power plant, but the impacts of the power plant have already been decided upon, and Southern California Edison has agreed to undertake mitigation for those effects, and they're moving forward on that, and we, as the Coastal Commission, are working with them to affect this.
Well, just to pursue that issue a moment, if they're taking mitigation effects, that sounds as though things happened, damage occurred that had not been anticipated in the beginning, and so they're doing something to fix that.
Well,
what are the kinds of impacts that have occurred that are now being mitigated?
There are several. For the discharge effects, there's impacts on the local kelp bed. There's about 150-acre loss of giant kelp and associated fish and the invertebrates.
Wetlands.
And
the wetlands.
That is a mitigation. Yeah.
Right.
And then there's something like a 600-ton loss of bite white fish stocks, and mitigation for the losses, the local losses to the kelp beds, are taking form of a reef, a large artificial reef, to produce 150 acres of kelp forest. And then mitigation for the intake effects is restoration of 150 acres of wetland, which is a rare habitat in Southern California.
And
so, Mary Jane Johnson, how are you doing the wetland mitigation?
Well,
are you
that's
actually
really not under my expertise.
Okay.
At the plant. However, I know that our company and various other agencies, Steve's and a lot of the environmental groups out here in Southern California are jointly doing this as a team, and they are moving forward. I know that in November of 97, it just got our plan got accepted to move forward on the wetland.
Very briefly, Dr. Schroeder, is this mitigation activity going to work? Is it actually going to restore the ecosystems that were damaged?
We really hope so. Everybody's making a concerted effort to make it work, and there's independent monitoring associated with it. And as Mary Jane said, we're working very hard with Edison to affect it.
Good. And what you have told us, something that I didn't know before, that the business of sucking the water in can be as much of a problem as getting it out.
Yep.
So I'm afraid our time is up. My guests have been Mary Jane Johnson from the Southern California Edison Company, Paul Richter from the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board, and Dr. Steve Schroeder from the San Diego State University and a scientist with the California Coastal Commission. We've been talking green about discharging heat and taking water into nuclear power plants, and I'm Peter Burley.
You can hear The Environment Show anytime through your personal computer. Our website is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author David Peterson, it's winter among the tall aspens at his home in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. In this portrait of place, Peterson reads from his book titled The Nearby Far Away, A Personal Journey Through the Heart of the West.
10 long weeks have passed since the annual Thanksgiving snowstorm blew in to isolate and insulate this southern Colorado mountainside I call home. A meek sun rides low on the southern sky these brief winter days, that is, when it isn't obscured by the ghostly fog of a whiteout. In such conditions, white above, white below, white all around, the barren aspens picketing our little handmade cabin seem gray, sad, pensive. Or perhaps I'm investing them with my own melancholy. Golden autumn is a mere faint memory, verdant spring a distant, impossible dream. Cabin fever is endemic. But even up here in the frozen white Rockies, life goes on, especially around the aspen tree where the bird feeder hangs. To this winter oasis flock not just birds, but tassel-eared squirrels, lean brown cottontails, and plump white snowshoe hares, and keeping watch with winter-hungry eyes from atop nearby evergreens, hawks, eagles, falcons. One crackling cold morning not long ago, as I stood at the window sipping coffee, a quick dark shadow dropped from above to knock one of the dove-sized birds from the feeder, pinning it to the ground below. Cooper's hawk. It's hard, but it works. Sudden, violent death by predation is not an image that soon fades from the mind's eye, nor should it, for it's an analogy worth personalizing, expanding, pondering. Death is the meat of life, all life. Hunger haunts the snowy ground as well. Recently, Caroline was outside with her black lab, Otis, when she noticed an unfamiliar chittering call like no bird you've ever heard. She looked but saw nothing. Then from beneath the woodpile burst what she described as a whirling ball of white. What it was an ermine, a winter white weasel, its barracuda teeth fastened to a cottontail's neck. Otis missed none of this, of course, and in a flash was on the move. 90 growling pounds of fury bearing down on you isn't something easily overlooked, even in the midst of a life and death struggle. Startled, the ermine relaxed its grip and the rabbit squirted away. The weasel streaked off after the rabbit, Otis after the weasel. Caroline called Otis back, and that was that. So it goes, high in the Rockies, deep in winter. But for every life ended, another is begun. Just yesterday, half a mile east of here, I found a dozen big oval snow depressions where elk had bedded, the females among them bearing new life within. New life, wildlife, like the rest of us up here, biding our time, waiting out winter. Sometimes, on the drabbest of days, melancholy shrouds me like a fog. I lost two cherished companions recently, one a man, the other man's best friend. Both weigh heavy on my mood as I sit here on this cold winter's eve, scribbling. After a while, I rise from my rocker and venture out into the frozen night. All around me, stoic aspens stand tall and straight against winter's dark and cold, naked ivory pillars glowing eerily under a waning moon. Already, I'm noticing, the aspen buds are swelling, reddening, blushing with the promise of spring.
That was author David Peterson reading from his book titled The Nearby Far Away, A Personal Journey Through the Heart of the West. It's published by Johnson Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you're a sapodilla picker and looking for work, you need a copy. It's show number 430, and tapes are available for $10 from WAMC, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The Environment Show is a national production, which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.